The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are outside Vinoteca in London, St. Pancras, just a few days before the start of the Vuelta a España. Daniel and I will be flying out at the end of the week to... you'll be coming out, Richard, for the second half of the race. And we're baking in the London sunshine, just getting acclimatised, ready for the Vuelta.
Danger that you might get sunburned before you get to Malaga.
A very high possibility, yeah. Although I think the cloud is going to just obscure the sun
slightly. You need a knotted handkerchief on your head.
I'll fit right in down in Marbs, won't I, eh?
Anyway, my name is Richard Moore, that's Lionel Burney, and we're joined by Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
Daniel making a rare visit to back to the motherland.
Don't tell
Daniel,
the tax man.
Well, welcome. Welcome. I thought this was one of the days that you were allowed here, no? Anyway, all that aside, this is our final podcast for the third Grand Tour, and... Well, now seems as good a time as any to confirm that we will once again be bringing you daily coverage. I'm sure everybody assumed that anyway.
Yeah, well, and it'll be...
It's established now, isn't it?
It's established, yeah. We're in the groove, the three Grand Tours. But a bit of a rotation system in team selection. TV's Daniel Freeb will be working for TV, but we'll be hoping to get you on the podcast pretty regularly, if not every day. Hopefully every day,
yeah,
Daniel.
It was pretty much every day last year, wasn't it?
Good. Good.
Depends what blandishments and incentives you can offer.
Oh, we've got lots of things up our sleeve, don't worry.
Yeah, well, we can. What can we offer you? We can offer you...
Hamon, I suspect.
Yeah, why not?
And
our Spanish correspondent, Fran Reyes, will be joining us as well, pretty much every day.
I think
he's going for... he's got a weekend off to attend a wedding, a friend's wedding, I think.
Mm. It's all very casual, isn't it, the Vuelta? You don't get this kind of thing at the Tour. You don't get people... swanning off on weddings.
Or it's the holiday
or
grand tour.
In whenever they want.
The holiday grand tour, Richard. I'm taking my sombrero and my stuffed donkey out to Spain.
Bucket and spade.
I'll be there the first 9 days with Fran and Daniel, and then after the first rest day, I'll be heading home. Important business to deal with at home, and Richard will be. You'll be replacing me for the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So I'm very much the Mario Cipollini of this Vuelta.
What, 9 days at the beach and then home to the beach?
You're going to punch a Spanish domestique after 4 stages and get sent home.
In the year 2000,
Mario Cipollini punched Francisco Cerezo, I think his name was, and got sent home, didn't he?
He did, that's right. No, I'm not going to do that.
Lionel usually punches some lowly domestique at these things.
Never.
That's a joke.
Never. Absolutely not. No, looking forward to it.
There have been a few dust-ups at the Vuelta over the years. There was one with... Brambilan, who was the other rider?
Ivan Rovni.
Ivan Rovni, and then there was the one between Leonardo Sierra and another Spanish rider in 1994, I think.
Yeah, that was the one.
Carrera, Sierra.
They came to blows on the road, skidding about in their cycling shoes. Quite comical, really.
And I think the footage of that... Alcala at some point? Was that the Vuelta? Was that somewhere else?
I don't know. It's not the cycling boxing podcast, is it? Dust ups in the Vuelta.
Googling here.
Why is that? These days, is it because it's so hot, tempers get frayed in the late season sun?
I don't know. You would know, Lionel, best than anyone, how tempers can get frayed. The Leonardo Sierra, of course, was known as the Tigre de Mamporal, the Tiger of Mamporal. Yeah, we've gone off on rather tangent.
But yeah, our daily coverage, daily, nightly episodes from the Vuelta, thanks to our headline sponsor, Rafa, and Science and Sport, of course, and Kilometre Zero, 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday and Friday, brought to you by The Economist at the Vuelta. So we're very grateful to them for stepping up to the plate, so to speak, and backing Kilometre Zero. So that will be available to everyone to listen to, and... got a few of those in the pipeline already, so we're all looking forward to that. We will talk about the Vuelta, we'll look ahead to the Vuelta in this episode, but before we do, there has been some racing, some good racing. Lionel, can you give us a bit of a news roundup?
I will do, yeah. Quite a bit of racing. Lots of racing if you've got Eurosport. At one point last week, you could watch four races on the same day. It was, an absolute glut of reasonable cycling coverage. I mean, some of the racing, I found a bit of a struggle. The Tour of Hungary, I mean, interesting country, very nice to see, but the level of racing perhaps not as high as in the World Tour. The biggest race of the week was the Binkbank Tour, formerly known as the Eneco Tour, of course, going from the Netherlands to Belgium. A very impressive overall victory by Matej Mohoric, still only 23 years of age and seems to have been at a very high level for, well, a lot of years now. Won a stage at the Giro in impressive style this year, won a stage at the Vuelta last year, and now the overall winner of the Binkbank Tour. Michael Matthews, who's had a real patchy season this season, won the final stage in Hedarsberg, and he was second overall, and Tim Wellens of Belgium was third. There was the Arctic Race of Norway, a stunning-looking countryside again. Daniel, you've been there, haven't you?
I have.
Yeah, beautiful.
Visited, the race visited some similar, well, some of the same towns that I...
Gatecrashed a hen night, as I recall.
Oh, no, I was gatecrashed by a hen night.
Okay, sorry, the other way around.
Well, I don't know whether there are any hen nights on the Arctic Race of Norway this year, but Astana's Sergei Chernevsky won overall there. There was the Euro-Eyes Cyclassics race in Hamburg. This is the one-day race that's traditionally won by sprinters. Elia Viviani won for the second year in a row there, ahead of Arno Demar and Alexander Kristoff. Back in Norway, Marianne Voss won the Women's Tour of Norway and a couple of stages there.
She won all the stages there.
You sure about that? Okay. Stand corrected. A few more transfers have been confirmed. Quite a busy transfer season this year. Lars Bak is moving to Dimension Data from Lotto Soudal. Jürgen Rolands is moving from Lotto Soudal to Movistar. And Moreno Hoffland from Lotto Soudal to EF Education First. And Nicky Terpstra, this is an interesting transfer. Quick Step to Direct Energy. And Patrick Lefebvre still looking for a title sponsor for 2019. The seeming perennial search for a title sponsor that Patrick Lefebvre is engaged in. But Terpstra to Direct Energy, that's an unusual one, and Lefebvre openly admitting he couldn't afford to keep Terpstra.
Well, we talked a lot last year, didn't we, about the quandary that Quickstep's success has left them in, namely that their riders are increasing their value all the time. And this year, from Quickstep's point of view, is actually not a bad year in the sense that they haven't had too many riders out of contract. Last year, there were an awful lot of riders, and Patrick Lefebvre had to do a lot of pack shuffling and obviously did a pretty good job because they've had a wildly successful season. But Terpstra was the big one this year. And I've noticed, well, this is no secret really, that a lot of team managers have been really biding their time this year, not knowing how things were going to shake out with BMC. And they, I think a lot of them sensed at one point that the market would be flooded with quite cheap riders. It would be a buyer's market. And I think Lefebvre possibly did that to a certain extent with Terpstra, although he's also talked about budget restrictions. Jean-René Bernardeau, the manager of Direct Energy, of course, he's pulled off a similarly unlikely coup before when he signed away. It proved not to be a coup because it was he proved to be a bit of a dud for the team. But Josipa Beloki, when he came back from his terrible crash in the 2003 Tour de France, Beloki went to Jean-René Bernardeau's
team.
Yeah,
I mean, this is completely different, though, isn't it? I mean, Terpstra is still kind of at the top of his game when it comes 34. To the classics. 34 years of age, yeah. It reminds me of the old Bill Shankly quote about when to move on footballers. Make sure your players' legs go on another manager's pitch. And, you know,
Terpstra... Dave Brailsford has a similar... He's got a bell curve, hasn't he? And there's a point in that curve where riders are let go.
Better to let go of a rider a year too early than a year too late, I guess. Especially when with somebody like Terpstra, his kind of salary will have been rising over the last few years, particularly since his Monument win. So that's an interesting one. It might give Direct Energy, who've never really done much in the classics, might give them a presence in certainly Paris-Roubaix.
A lot of Terpstra's wins have come when he's not, and perhaps because he's not been the main man on the team, you know, and where, you know, even at the Tour of Flanders last year, when there are so many other riders in his team that people are watching that he can slip away. I mean, it's not as easy as that, and he still, you know, that was a hell of an effort when he got away with Nibali, of course, but you wonder how he'll fare as the talisman in those races.
Yeah. And, well, as everything leads towards the start of the Vuelta, down in Malaga, in the south of Spain, in Andalusia. The start list is getting pretty close to being fully confirmed. There may be a few late changes, but just to run through, it's looking like a really strong race, particularly in terms of the level of GC riders there. Vincenzo Nibali, former winner, of course, won in 2010. He will be riding for Bahrain Merida after crashing out of the Tour de France on Alpe d'Huez after being hit by a motorbike. Richie Port, also coming back after his crash at the Tour on the cobbles, on the stage to Roubaix. He leads a very strong-looking BMC team. Peter Sagan and Rafał Majka will both be riding for Bora Hansgrohe. Sagan's presence probably caused the shoulders of all the other sprinters in the race to slump slightly because, well, he could be up there and a factor in anything from flat to vaguely hilly. Adam and Simon Yates will be riding for Mitchelton Scott. Nairo Quintana and Valverde will be riding for Movistar. In a lot of ways, Movistar's tactics are simplified a bit. They had been intending to go to the Vuelta with the same three leaders that went to the Tour, Quintana, Valverde and Mikel Landa. But Mikel Landa is not going to be fit after his crash at the San Sebastian Classic the week after the Tour de France. So no Mikel Landa for the Vuelta. Rigoberto Urán and Michael Woods for EF Education First, and Steven Krausreich and George Bennett for Lotto NL Jumbo, and we think Fabio Aru and Dan Martin for UAE Team Emirates. So those teams have all got a two-pronged attack when it comes to the GC. A few lone wolves as well. Ilnur Zakarin from Katusha looking to back up an impressive Tour de France. Thibaut Pinot leading Groupama. Miguel Angel Lopez leading Astana. And Wilco Kelderman coming back, having missed the Tour de France that he was due to ride. He crashed a few days before, didn't he, in the national championships.
Not sure how impressed I was with Zakarin's Tour de France, Napalm.
Oh, I thought that was good. He rode his way into the top nine. Top nine in the final week. That was quite stealthy riding, a la Zubeldia.
No Russian interference in this podcast.
Were you underwhelmed?
Well, I know he was underwhelmed himself.
Well,
and Katusha were underwhelmed.
Yeah, okay, best of the rest, but, you know, a solid base upon which to mount a challenge for the top five.
Should we forget the rest of this podcast and spend the next half an hour, or what was going to be the rest of this podcast, spend the next half an hour
debating whether Zakarin had a good tour?
Yeah.
Let's go and ask him at the Vuelta whether he thought it was good.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. A reminder that there were extensive details in last week's cycling podcast, Femina, which was released towards the end of the week, of our Rafa Women's 100 ride, the first cycling podcast Femina Women's 100 ride. That's being organised by listener Hannah Nicklin. Daniel's ears must have been burning. Well, his ears were burning. Did you listen?
What was said, Daniel?
Oh, you'll have to go and listen to it. But you know, you were given quite a hard time for your comments last week about caffe stops. There will be two caffe stops in this ride. Go to rafa.cc. Women's 100.
More to the point, there'll be one bike ride in these two cafe stops, more like it.
Daniel.
In the morning. What is it? Is it taking place in the morning?
Daniel's volunteered to marshal.
There'll be a bike ride in this coffee morning.
He's going to marshal this
Unbelievable,
ride. We're getting
really?
Him a high-vis jacket. And
What's wrong with people doing what they want to do?
Coffee stops are outnumbering the bike rides. One bike ride, two coffee stops.
Actually, three bike rides, two coffee stops. Anyway, it should be good. It should be good, and it's on September the 15th. So as I say, go to rafa.cc, search for Women's 100, and you'll find the Cycling Podcast Femina ride if you scroll right down and register there. Now, you mentioned the racing that there has been, Lionel, the main one being the Bink Bank Tour, used to be the Eneco Tour, over lots of roads that we see more of around springtime, obviously. I really enjoy this race. Going back a few years, it was the first time I really appreciated the talent of Tom Dumoulin. And it's that sort of race where you can have riders who are classic specialists, riders who are stages riders, quite a mix. You know, guys coming out the Tour, riders preparing for the Vuelta, sprinters. Nobody, I don't think, would have predicted Matej Morhić as a winner. He's a phenomenal talent who he was... junior world champion, road race champion, and under 23 world champion in consecutive years. And I was in Florence when he won the under 23 world championship. It's the first time I ever saw the descending on the top tube, which is now de rigueur by him. He's a fantastic bike handler. And he gave a very, very good press conference here. He's a bright guy. It's a bit hard to say that he was a bit lost his first few years as a pro, because he was very, very young when he turned professional. And it's about now, age 23, when we'd expect him to be posting decent results. He won a stage at the Vuelta last year, won a stage at the Giro this year, but his win at the Bing Bank Tour was amazing, given the lack of team support that he had. It was him against some of the best riders in the world over that sort of terrain, and he dealt with it.
Yeah, and the fact that he didn't lay the foundation for that win with by winning or being in the top 10 even, I don't think, in the time trial. That's pretty unusual for that race. I mean, when you look back at the list of winners back to 2005, when the first race was held, won by Bobby Julik, really a lot of kind of ruler time trial riders have won it. It's a funny race. I've only ever been to it once, in 2007, I think it was. And it was weird to be in that part of the world, on those roads, in the summer. Nice weather it was then, and it's pretty nice weather this year as well. They are the roads and the terrain that you associate with the spring classics, and kind of feels a little bit alien to have a race on those roads. The final stage with the climb of the Mur in Hellersberg, and has become kind of iconic now. And that was without doubt the outstanding stage of the race. It was a real humdinger, sort of a mini classic race on the final day. But it's an interesting one. It's kind of a place for riders who aren't, you know, there's so many of these stage races at this time of year between the Tour de France and the Vuelta, particularly now with the Tour of Germany, or the Deutschland Tour, coming up next week as well. That will overlap, obviously, with the Vuelta. These kind of week-long races are getting a little bit... it's quite crowded, isn't it, the calendar, and it's quite hard to see the sort of definition of what these races actually mean. And so when you see somebody like Mohoric pull out a big result like that, you know, that's, for a young rider, still only 23, quite a big step up in terms of what he's achieved, I think.
It's a stage race for classics riders, isn't it? And there aren't many of those. And it was, you know, to see someone like Tim Wellens taking on, you know, the Michael Matthews, Oliver Nassens, those guys. One innovation which has featured in the last few editions, I think, of the race, the Golden Kilometre, which comes around about 20, 25 kilometres from the finish, where there are three intermediate sprints within a kilometre, with seconds on offer. They were really crucial because the race was very close. And on that final stage, Tim Wellens really buried himself to go for them, and kind of messed up his chances of going for the stage win and perhaps something better. So that had an effect on the race, an interesting effect on the race. But yeah, I mean, I think I'm so impressed by Mohoric. I don't know what kind of rider he's going to develop into. It's hard to tell. I mean, he's one of these guys who could be really versatile. He's very aerodynamic on the bike. He's got great position on the bike. He's really strong. He can obviously ride over the cobbles. He's probably a little bit too big to become a Grand Tour contender, but there doesn't seem a lot that he can't do, really, which could be a bit of a problem for him in a way.
Yeah, there's been a bit of a resurgence of that kind of rider, the very versatile rider, over the past couple of years. We heard for years that bike racing was becoming more and more specialised, and that also riders were targeting specific points of the year, and they were not going to perform for the rest of the year. And that trend has really been reversed for a number of reasons, I think, over the last few years. The best riders in the world tend to be competitive throughout the year now. Certainly the best stage racers in the world, they tend to competing for the top positions in stage races in February, and then again in the Grand Tours. And we've seen a few riders of Mohoric's ilk. A couple of weeks ago I spoke about Michael Valgren moving to Dimension Data. He's another one who, difficult to know what his new team Dimension Data will do with. Gianni Moscon is another one at Team Sky, Kwiatkowski. And I suppose it's a case of suck it and see with those guys. Send them to various different types of races and see where, evaluate after 2 or 3 years and where they're going to fare best. But with 2-year contracts, You don't necessarily, 2 year contracts being de rigueur still in professional cycling, it's difficult to have a kind of long term plan and commit to finding out where their speciality really lies over 2 or 3 seasons.
Wahlgren rode well as well for much of the final stage on a neutral service bike. He was up there in the break and he had to change bikes, and because the way the race was split up and team cars stuck behind, he couldn't change onto his team bike. So rode a lot of the stage on a neutral service bike, but rode extremely well. And yeah, he's exactly that sort of rider, isn't he? Very versatile.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the cycling podcast is sponsored by The Economist. Now, The Economist are sponsoring our forthcoming series of Kilometre Zero from the Vuelta a España, and we're incredibly grateful to them for that, because it means that those 9 episodes will be freely available for everyone to listen to. The Economist is about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from politics and business to science, technology, the arts and even sport. All of our listeners can get a free print copy of The Economist by texting cycling to 78070. Now, Rich, you've been reading The Economist this week. What has caught your eye?
Well, there have been a series of articles recently on Eritrea, the African country that's of particular interest really to cycling fans, because they've got a rich cycling tradition and a lot of good riders they've produced over recent years. Merhawi Kudus is riding the Vuelta for Dimension Data. Daniel Tekle-Heimanot is another one who's been riding some of the big races. And wherever you are in Europe at the Grand Tours, if there's an Eritrean rider riding, there will be a group of Eritrean fans, very vocal, very noisy, just like the Colombian fans who always turn out wherever you are to support the Colombian riders. And there's always a bit of mystery about who these people are. Some scepticism as well there has been over the years. We actually did a Kilometre Zero on the Eritrean fans and the riders and the cycling history there a couple of years ago from the Tour de France. But this series of articles have been really about Eritrea beginning finally to open up and ending some of the, well, I'm not sure if they're ending the practices such as compulsory conscription. And there are, it's indefinite. So there are lots of adult males in Eritrea who've been conscripts their virtually their whole lives. But Tom Gardner is the Economist correspondent based in Ethiopia. And he recently went to Eritrea, very unusual for a journalist to go to Eritrea, and reports back on what he found was a beautiful place, friendly place, and as I say, he's been documenting recently how that country is finally, you know, at peace with Ethiopia and beginning to open up.
Interesting. I'll look out for that series, because you always find, don't you, when journalists go to these closed countries that have shut themselves off from the rest of the world, that the story is a lot more complex and a lot more nuanced when people actually get up close and experience the country on the ground.
And if it did truly open up, wouldn't it be a fascinating place to go to and to witness and write about and record podcasts about the cycling scene that's there? And apparently there's a lot of races and as I say, a lot of support for cycling there.
Well, The Economist is the smart guide to the forces changing your world, and you can get your free copy now by texting the word cycling to 78070.
So, the Vuelta is upon us. You chaps are both going out for the start, so I've no doubt you've been studying the first week and the course the first week. I've obviously been looking at weeks 2 and 3. What can we expect from the opening stages?
Well, it's pretty typical, Rich, of Welters of the last few years, that sort of surf and turf formula. It's either stages either finish in seaside resorts or on mountain tops or hilltops. It's worked over the last few years. The race has been entertaining, spectacular, and Javier Guillen, the race director, has stayed faithful to that formula, really. The one change, I suppose, this year, a slight tweak, is that I think it's more conducive to the sprinters than it has been over recent years, and that's reflected in the start list. Well, it's also reflected, I think, by the fact that, well, it's the fact that the World Championship this year is not going to suit sprinters at all. That has had an effect on the start list to a certain extent. There are more sprinters in the race. So we've got Sagan, we've got Viviani, we've got up-and-coming sprinters like Max Valscheid and guys who previously would have stayed away simply because there weren't enough opportunities. The first week, there are a good four or five. They'll have to work quite hard to get to the finales. There are some climbs on the way. But, yeah, I expect Sagan in particular to be, well, hard to beat there. And then you've also got guys like Matteo Trentin, who's won stages, sprint stages at the Vuelta before. And as far as the mountains are concerned, so we spend almost the entire first week in Andalusia, so that's the deep south of Spain. It's going to be very hot. There's an uphill finish at the Caminito del Rey on the second stage, and then the first real mountaintop finish is the Sierra de la Alfaguara, stage four, which is just kind of the backside of the Sierra Nevada. But then the really serious stuff doesn't really start till La Covatilla, which is up in kind of Roberto Heras country, not far from Salamanca. And then the last half of the race is a real glut of mountains. Typical Vuelta finishes, some really, really steep, short ones. And then some classics like Lagos de Covadonga and two really, really extremely difficult stages in Andorra to finish.
I think one of the interesting things about the opening weekend is that it's an individual time trial for the first time since 2009. The Vuelta has kind of made a team time trial, their kind of traditional opener. I don't think it's been a team time trial every year. There've been just road stages to kick off as well. But the first individual time trial since 2009, and that would be quite interesting because if it was a team time trial, you would think, well, BMC would win it. And Richie Porte would get a tremendous kind of boost on the first day. But with it being an individual time trial, we get to see just where the GC riders, you know, who somebody will lose sort of 15, 20 seconds, or you know, there'll be somebody who has a bad day, or and will be on the back foot right from the off. So it's an interesting little start, really, particularly when you say, Daniel, you know, a couple of tricky stages, stages two and four, where you know, the temptation will be to be good early, but then, as you say, the back half of the race is when it's going to be all decided. So being good in the first week, probably not that important in the grand scheme of things.
And 40 kilometres of time trialling in total, Napalm, that's not a huge amount, is it? But then there aren't too many time trial specialists among the overall favourites. Richie Porte is probably the one with the best credentials.
I mean, we'd fancy probably a BMC rider to be leading the race, Rohan Dennis, to win that time trial. I would think he'd be the strong favourite. And I don't know what his ambitions are at the Vuelta, but remember at the Giro, he was riding that for GC. You know, he kind of fell away the last couple of days or the last week. And I can't remember where he finished exactly, but, you know, it was a long way down in the end. But I think he felt it was a worthwhile exercise. And be curious to see how he will ride the Vuelta, whether he will take a similar approach. I think the other interesting thing with that team is that he's moving on. He's joining Barry Morita next year. So is Richie Porte. And that's always an interesting question as well, just how, you know, united these guys are when they're moving on next year, and whether, you know, someone like Rohan Dennis will have perhaps personal ambitions. Will he be willing to sacrifice those to help Richie Porte when they won't be teammates next year, when the team he's riding for now won't really exist? I mean, it's becoming a new team, effectively. And I think these are things that are quite interesting at the Vuelta in particular.
It can seem a bit of a paradox, Rich, that someone like Rohan Dennis, so someone over whose climbing there is a big question mark, that he might do very well in the Vuelta, considering that the Vuelta is notorious now for its steep climbs and very difficult climbs. However, as we saw with Tom Dumoulin in 2015, it's often the first pointer or the first big step that guys make in their development towards becoming Grand Tour specialists, the time trialists in particular. And I think for the most part, that's because the climbs tend to be quite short, and the bigger guys, if they have an Achilles heel when it comes to climbing, it tends not to be the gradient, and it tends to be the length of climbs. And yeah, that's probably going to apply this year until the final week, or the Friday, the last Friday and the last Saturday in Andorra, when the climbs are more of a kind of Tour de France style, and then they are really extreme mountain stages.
Just add to that, he was 16th in the Giro, which sounds like a pretty respectable placing, but almost an hour down, 56 minutes down. Mm. So, you know, well out of it. But
lost a lot again there on the last couple of days, didn't he?
Like Simon Yates. I mean, who's the favourite for this Vuelta? It's very hard to...
So you'd have to say, Nairo Quintana, because he has, by his standards, had a very poor Tour de France, really. I mean...
He's beaten by Ilner Zakarin.
and really kind of blew in the last few days in the mountains. Never really looked all that good. Kind of the sort of the two Bob Rocket attack that saw him going off the front on those rare occasions. At them, he'd be going backwards twice as quickly and conceding more than he was ever looking like he might gain. But has the pedigree. Will have the Tour in his legs. Has Valverde alongside him again. There'll be a strong team. And as we saw a couple of years ago when he won the Vuelta, difficult to beat. As you say, Daniel, the shorter mountain climbs might help him out. And if he gets into a good position. But he's the only one who hasn't got isn't coming back from an actual injury. Richie Porte and Vincenzo Nibali. Nibali is, not been back on his bike, has he, since the Tour de France, I don't think. Is that right?
Well, he's not raced, no.
That's what I mean. He's been on his bike.
Even just down the shops.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's not raced since crashing out of the Tour. So, question marks over him. But I would say Quintana just a smidge ahead of Nibali. Just because of experience, I think.
Nibali said he's not going to ride for GC, so...
Oh, well, there we are.
There we go. I mean, Simon Yates and Richie Porte are the bookies' favourites. I would agree with you on Quintana, Napalm, not least because Quintana's second Grand Tour of the year has tended to be as good, if not better, than the first one he's ridden. He's a guy who's a bit of a diesel, gets better with more kilometres in his legs. Yates, I think, will take... we've said it before, will take so much from the experience in the Giro. He's rare among these contenders in that he has... prepared solidly for the Vuelta, focused on the Vuelta, and the course suits him. You know, 40 kilometres of time trialing, those short steep climbs. Interesting that the big challenge, the hardest mountain stages of this race, come so far towards the back, where if he does go into those two stages close to the lead or in the lead, he'll be slightly twitchy, I'm sure, and fear a repeat of the Giro.
So will Matt White, his sports director, and I spoke quickly to Matt White the other day, just as he was building up for the Vuelta, about the Yates brothers, and they've got Mathieu Trentin as well in that team, who won so many stages last year, although not ultimately the points jersey, did they? But they'll be fighting on different fronts, I think, and they're going quite optimistic with the Yates twins. So here's briefly what Matt White said. I mean, Matt, obviously Adam Yates is now in the Vuelta. I know that was a bit of a change. Was that mainly because of how well he came out of the Tour? Because I know it wasn't originally on his programme.
Yeah, look, his selection to do the Vuelta is a couple of reasons. One, he did exit the Tour quite well. I think the one reason he exited the Tour quite well is that after he had the bad day there on stage 11, he had a couple of days to obviously enforced rest before we let him loose on the chance to go looking for stage wins in that second half of the Tour. So I suppose he didn't push. He didn't push for 20 days like most GC guys would. So that probably helped the way that he finished the Tour, and he saw him finish off very strongly in that time trial, stage 20 time trial as well. The other one was we just wanted to go over that process of going through another Grand Tour again before next year, and because when things don't go as planned, I think it's probably when you sit back and analyse where can you improve on next year. And the big thing for improving for Adam is just experience as well, to have two Grand Tours in a year, and even though he's not going to the Vuelta for GC, just having one more Grand Tour under the belt will certainly be a benefit for next year.
And Simon, I mean, we've not seen a lot of him since the Giro, but he rode very well in Poland, went pretty close to the win overall and won that final stage. What's he been up to since the Giro, and what sort of shape is he in compared to the Giro?
Yeah, look, he's in a good place. After the Giro, he was pretty mentally and physically tired after that race. Obviously, going so close to winning the race, and obviously being one of the dominators of the race there, winning so many stages, and and taking it all within his stride there. It left him pretty deflated, and actually he got quite sick after the race finished. Within 48 hours, he was man down. So he needed quite a good period off the bike. But as you saw there, he exited to Rapolan with a really nice win on the last day, and was also very close to robbing Mikel Kitowski from the overall lead. So his preparation's been different. Obviously, you approach the second Grand Tour quite differently to your first one of the year. But I think we're in a good place going into the start of the World Cup.
I mean, can he try and win the Vuelta? Is that a realistic ambition for him? Because it looks pretty open, you know, and we have a race here without a... with the Team Sky without an obvious leader, does that change things? And can Simon really target, you know, the overall win here?
Simon's been very ambitious, as we are as a team as well. I think the main thing for us is to learn from where we made some mistakes in the Giro and apply those in the Vuelta, and that is finishing the Vuelta really strongly. I think the Vuelta will be won and lost pretty much in the last 48 hours in Andorra. Obviously, you can't be giving away time at the first part of the Vuelta, but the idea for the team is to obviously hit someone to finish very strong in the Vuelta, and we're confident that he's going to be in the mix of guys. And I agree. I think it's a very open race. I think Movistar are going to have, on paper, the best team there, definitely, even without Lander, having Quintana and Valverde and Carapaz. That's three very, very strong climbers, and they'll have a very good support crew around them. And then, yeah, you've got Richie Port. It's a big unknown where he's going to be after the Tour. Zakarin's there, who rode very well last year to finish third with the Tour in his legs. There's some unknown quantities. Kruiswijk's lining up. How's he going to be post-Tour de France? There's always some surprises in the Vuelta, and the big one is obviously Sky without Froome or Geraint Thomas there. They're probably going to be riding a little bit more aggressive than they usually ride, and probably looking for more stage wins and maybe an overall podium.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Kiss goodbye to stomach problems with the world's first truly isotonic gel. Science in Sport Go Energy Isotonic. Before you hit the wall, hit back.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can still get your 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. Actually, we mistakenly played a question last week, a nutrition question that we'd played before, on whether fish and chips was a good... it wasn't because Lionel got into the Dropbox folder and
such a good question.
Yeah,
playing it again. Yeah,
that's from Lionel Burney and not Watford. No, but anyway, thank you to Science and Sport. We're very grateful to them for their support. Carrying on with the Vuelta, we heard Matt White there before the break. Sorry about the line, wasn't great quality. He was speaking at home in Spain, but he's admitting now that they did make a mistake at the Giro in the way that Simon Yates rode, where, you know, he had that fabulous form for the first 2 weeks of the race, and their attitude, their policy then was to really, you know, make hay while they could and gather as much time, as many time bonuses, stage wins while he was going so well, rather than just asking him to throttle back a bit. Who knows whether that had any effect on you know, how he was in the final week? But the feeling was certainly that after the final time trial at the start of the third week, he went pretty deep in that race and maybe didn't recover, and obviously paid for that in the end. We just don't know if he'd ridden slightly more conservatively in the first couple of weeks, whether he'd have gone better towards the end. We just don't know. But as you say, Lionel, if he's in a position going before those stages in Andorra, which are more kind of Giro Tour de France style mountain stages, aren't they really? Whether he will feel, you know, how he'll feel about that in terms of, you know, what happened before.
The psychological scars. Exactly, I mean, yeah, that must have been pretty scarring, or take a bit of banishing the memory of just being completely empty when in the pink jersey, and then, you know, seeing the race just go away in such dramatic style over what, the course of 45 minutes, really. You know,
Matt White said that he really crashed after the Giro and fell properly ill. Mm. You know, he went right down and has... Build back up, but as we saw at the Tour of Poland a couple of weeks ago, he's obviously in great form.
The difference with the Vuelta is that he wouldn't find himself in the same position with a sort of a rampaging Chris Froome with nothing to lose. You know, there's no one in the field that you would say would turn down, would turn down, say, third place in order to chase first place in quite such a dramatic way. You wouldn't have thought. And just to pick up on what Daniel says, Vincenzo Nibali has said, I mean, yeah, maybe not. Maybe the GC is not his goal. Maybe the World Championships in Innsbruck is more of a target. But again, you know, he's a wily old character, isn't he, Nibali? You couldn't rule him out being in contention going into those final couple of stages in Andorra and doing what he did at the Giro in 2016 and turning it on its head. And, you know, he's not going to, I wouldn't imagine he's going to allow himself to be ridden completely out of contention in the first week or 10 days. So it could be a really open race. And in that sense, Simon Yates won't have to do what he did at the Giro in this making hay while the sun shines, fearing that others might attack him in the final week. He can afford to ride on the shoulders a bit more.
We mentioned Nibali's caginess. A lot of the general classification contenders are being pretty cagey. Richie Port is as well. He's said that he's not in the same form as he was ahead of the Tour de France. One rider who I think has made no secret of his ambitions is Thibaut Pinot, who we haven't mentioned, hasn't got great pedigree in the Vuelta a España. He's ridden it a couple of times, but without really targeting the general classification. But he should also should be in good form and on a course as climb heavy as this one, should be, I think, among the favourites. I think he'll need to rediscover some of the time trialing form that's deserted him of late. He rode a poor time trial in the Giro, has ridden a few poor time trials over the last couple of years. But I think he's in the shake-up for the podium. And another name we haven't mentioned is Miguel Angel Lopez, who was one of the stars of the Vuelta Mountain Stages last year, won a couple of them, and finished third in the Giro. So, you know, he's moving through the gears as far as Grand Tours are concerned, and his trajectory over the last couple of years has been pretty linear. And the last step for him really is to win one of these.
Strong team as well, very strong team. Astana, Pello Bilbao, Dario Cattardo, Omar Fraile, Jan Hurt as well, another strong rider. Really, a really strong team. Davide Villela, who won the King of the Mountains last year at the Vuelta, didn't he? So.
Just on Pinot, Daniel, am I right in thinking that the heat is a bit of an Achilles heel for Thibaut Pinot?
It could be, Napalm. You're right.
I mean, looking at the forecast, I mean, weather forecast is for sort of low 30s to maybe mid 30s. I think the bit where it goes up away from the coast into the middle of Spain, the kind of Castilla region across towards Extremadura, that could be pretty roasting hot. But I mean, fortunately, it doesn't look like the heat wave from earlier this month where Portugal and southern Spain was kind of hitting 40 degrees. I mean, that's presumably not going to happen. I'm hoping that doesn't happen because I'm the Thibaut Pinot of the podcast. I wilt in the heat.
We talked about mental hurdles, Napalm, but there is a bit of a suspicion that Pinot has a habit of sort of creating mental hurdles. It happened early in his career with descending and he overcame that, fortunately. He's got another one with rest days, and the stage after rest days, he's generally not gone very well, and that was the case in the Giro this year. And you know, when he talks about the heat, he talks about the fact that his family has lived in an area of France where it's usually pretty dank and humid and quite cool, so the Vosges for generations, and he thinks this has an effect on his ability to withstand the heat now.
This is really interesting, though, and goes back to kind of Simon Yates and the psychological scars of what happened at the Giro. The kind of the mental hurdles that riders put in front of themselves. I mean, not to be discounted in terms of how important the mental fortitude is in a three-week race. If you've had a bad experience, I mean, think back. It's only the Giro a few months ago when Pinot effectively put himself in hospital with dehydration and again little triggers in his mind of when things are perhaps escaping him, getting away from him. All this kind of stuff is really fascinating.
I mean, and Richie Port and crashing, you know, he's crashed out of the last two Tours de France. you know, it feels like every Grand Tour he starts now is the last chance he'll have to really to try and win one. He'll have taken a lot of heart, I think, from Geraint Thomas, another rider who has had so much bad luck in his career, putting together the perfect race over 3 weeks. That could happen for Richie Porte, but none of these guys going into this race are going to be going in without doubts and questions in their mind, even someone as kind of impenetrable as Nairo Quintana, you know, because since he won the Vuelta 2 years ago, he's been on a bit of a, for him, a downward sort of trajectory. You know, he's not kicked on from that. He didn't win the Giro last year, didn't go anywhere near winning the Tour, this year. You know, he's got, there'll be doubts playing it on his mind as well. And it, I think one of the really interesting things about this Vuelta is there's no Team Sky with a clear leader who's a clear overall contender. They've got David de la Cruz, who they say is leading the team. Michał Kwiatkowski maybe using the race more for preparation for World Championships. And I mean, Matt White said he thinks that Team Sky will be very, very aggressive and be out to win stages, because I don't think winning the race overall is really within David de la Cruz's grasp.
No, but more importantly than the race itself, Spain. It's the third Grand Tour of the season, another country to go and explore.
It happens in Spain.
Daniel, I mean, I've been a little bit down on the opening few days. I mean, Malaga is a lovely city. Granada is a lovely city where there's a start. But we also go to Marbella, which a lot of British holidaymakers will presumably know very well. That coast is pretty well developed, isn't it? But a couple of the stages are going inland. I'm very excited about going to Malaga because Watford's manager, Javi Gracia, was a coach of Malaga for a couple of years. And Victor, Fran Reyes' friend, Victor, who we travelled with for a few days last year, Malaga.
It was only one day. It just felt like a few days. No, it wasn't. It was a few days.
That was Fran's driving. I have nightmares about Fran's driving.
Victor, the only thing or person who, well, it feels like, he's the only thing or person stopping Fran from going completely off the rails.
He's a very, very calming influence on Fran. I'm hoping to hook up with Victor quite a bit in the first week. But it's sort of hugs the coast, doesn't it, round into Murcia, and then doubles back on itself across into the centre of Spain, a region I really know absolutely nothing about, about stage 5 to stage 9 to La Covatilla. Is that that's the first sort of serious mountain stage, isn't it? That would be my finish line for this Vuelta. But I'm looking forward to sort of discovering a bit about Spain, and it's, it looks pretty rural, that bit across. We're going to go from one extreme to the other, very touristy down the south coast and then pretty rural in the centre.
Yeah, it hasn't got such long transfers this year as it has done in the past few years. Avoid or skirt around the hot regions in the sort of inland in the south, Extremadura, and go up towards Galicia in the northwest corner. Unfortunately, one day in Galicia that I'm particularly looking forward to, Napalm, which finishes at the Faro de Estaca, a lighthouse right on a peninsula up in Galicia. That should be spectacular. And then we've got a number of stages in Cantabria and Asturias, as has been the norm over the past few years, the northern sort of coastal regions, very green, beautiful mountains inland. And some good wine, Napalm.
Yeah, I enjoyed Asturias last year very much. But I've no desire to see Andorra again so soon. So, Rich, you can enjoy a couple of days in Andorra, where you can blow the cycling podcast budget on data roaming, I expect.
Data roaming. I can't wait to do a bit of data roaming in Andorra. It's my favourite activity, that and laundry. It seems like a long way away, Andorra, and it is. And it's a long way from Andorra to Madrid. I mean, setting new records, these Grand Tours, for penultimate stages to finish cities. Ridiculous, really. Those 2 days in Andorra, I mean, a lot of the riders will be very familiar with the roads. We heard from George Bennett last week, who's riding for Lotto NL Jumbo with Stephen Kruijswijk. He's one of the riders who spends a lot of time in Andorra, but the Yates twins are there. I mean, lots of them are based at Dan Martin. So they'll know those roads and they'll know those stages very, very well. Anyone else to highlight? I mean, as you say, it's a good sprinting field this year, and Viviani looks pretty irresistible. He's had an amazing season. It'd be difficult for Trentin to repeat what he did last year, but he will have a bit of freedom. Other than just, I get the impression on paper, you would say Adam Yates came out the tour having had a poor tour, mainly because he was dehydrated in the Alps and the Alpe d'Huez stage and suffered from that. But he came out the tour very strongly. You know, he's a guy who's finished fourth in the Tour de France before. Simon Yates, proven Grand Tour credentials as well. On paper, they've got a really good chance at this Vuelta, and yet I feel that they're more low key about it than they were at the Giro. At the Giro, when you look at the team they had and the focus they had on the race right from the start, it felt like, you know, that was their major target of the year. And in fact, when Matt White came over last year, you know, I remember him talking. I think the Giro is a race that he loves personally, and that's maybe one reason for that. But Vuelta, they seem to be going in pretty relaxed, but with, on paper, a very good team.
The other thing is, it will likely be Peter Sagan's run in the rainbow jersey will come to an end, presumably in Innsbruck. I can't see him winning in Innsbruck, although you wouldn't put it past. Well, you would put it past him. I think the course is a bit too much even for him. But like I said at the start, for the other sprinters, you know, they are the kind of the roadman sprinters, Mattia Trentin, Elia Viviani to an extent. Probably groaned a bit when Peter Sagan confirmed he would be riding the Vuelta, and you wouldn't put it past Sagan winning, you know, a good handful of stages.
Anyone else worth mentioning? Louis Menkes, another guy who's had a very, very disappointing season with Dimension
Data.
We can
mention the whole start list.
Oh,
we can go down.
Good. We could.
I mean, yeah, I think
there's a guy who needs a year or so ago was being talked about as certainly a podium contender.
Bottom half of the top 10. I don't think he's ever shown anything more than that. And I think if he finished somewhere between sort of 6th and 12th, you'd say, you know, that's basically par for Menkes.
All right, I'm not going to mention any more names. That's it. That's it. That's all. That's all for our Vuelta preview.
There's 3 weeks of mentioning names, yeah. Richard, every night.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, good luck to you two, chaps.
Thank you.
You know, I hope that the podcast will be in safe hands.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll try not to drop it before you come out to Salamanca or wherever it is you're picking
Salamanca,
it up.
Yeah, I'll be picking up in Salamanca. Start of week 2, and looking forward to it. Lionel sheltering there from the sun.
Oh,
this doesn't augur well.
I'm going to be lobster pink before I even get to Marbella.
Your face does not augur well for Malaga. Daniel, on the other hand, looking very cool there in his summer shirt and with his Grand Tour haircut, all ready to go. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Facebook and iTunes. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Adam Bowie.